ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime. I'm Nate Geraci. Actually rolling solo today. No Connor Kelly or Jason Lank, both of whom are enjoying a little summer vacation. But nonetheless, I have a fantastic show lined up for you today. In just a moment, ETF.com's Drew Voris will join me to discuss the second fastest ETF to ever reach $1 billion. This ETF launched in June, and it already has over $1.5 billion invested in it. It's the JP Morgan Beta Builders Japan ETF. The only other ETF to reach $1 billion faster was the Spider Gold Shares, ticker GLD. I think this is an interesting story because there's so much more here than meets the eye. This isn't just investors wanting exposure to Japanese stocks. So we'll look at this from multiple angles with Drew in just a moment. I'll then be joined by Toby Lofton, managing principal at BP Capital Fund Advisors. He's going to walk us through the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF. This is the ETF that billionaire T. Boone Pickens has put his name behind. And the idea is to take a much more innovative approach to investing in the energy space than what you might find with traditional energy sector ETFs. And then we'll close the show today with Matt Bielski, CEO of Defiance ETFs. He's going to spotlight a brand new ETF that just launched last week, the Defiance Future Tech ETF, which focuses on the augmented and virtual reality space. So I think augmented reality probably popped on everyone's radar a couple of years ago with Pokemon, right? The Nintendo game everyone was walking around with on their iPhones. But this space is rapidly evolving. There are some fascinating things occurring here. So we'll have Matt take us through some of those, along with a virtual reality space. Really looking forward to that conversation. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Let's start the show today with ETF.com's editor-in-chief, Drew Voris.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Drew, so the JP Morgan Beta Builders Japan ETF, ticker symbol BBJP, this is the second fastest ETF to ever reach $1 billion behind GLD. And as I mentioned, there is a lot more to this story than just investors wanting exposure to Japanese stocks. I know you've done a little detective work behind the scenes, and we'll get to that. But first, just tell us a little bit more about the ETF itself, maybe how it compares to the competition, and perhaps walk us through the recent flows here.
Yeah, sure thing, Nate. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be on. What's interesting here, it's really not a Japan story. It's really, in some ways, an industry story. It's also sort of the evolution of the way the future of investing. And when you see a big investment bank like JP Morgan jumping headfirst into the ETF waters now, finally, they've been around for a couple of years, kind of dabbling. What we're seeing is sort of a branding going on, Beta Builder, which is sort of ironic for JP Morgan, as very well known as an active manager. But they have basically these really core kind of vanilla funds that they're starting. And, of course, they started with Japan Fund. And for investors, Japan is usually a pocket of diversification, stable, safe haven kind of place. And what was interesting that we saw on the flows, one, you're right, Nate, it was the second fastest to $1 billion in assets under management. And we attribute that a lot to being just J.P. Morgan clients because we saw big chunks move in. And that's a little unusual for sort of a vanilla launch like Japan. But what's interesting, it's competition, which is the iShares, the iShares MSCI Japan ETF, EWJ, saw similar outflows as we were seeing inflows of that nature into BBJP. And in fact, right now, Nate, it's at $1.75 billion. We're probably going to hit $2 billion in a couple weeks here. And the other competing fund, EWJ, has over $17 billion in assets. But here's the difference. EWJ has an expense ratio of 49 basis points, whereas BBJP has 19 basis points. So the move out of there is a pretty easy steer, especially when the overlap is almost very similar. The top funds in both those, as you would expect, in a Japan equity fund are Toyota, Mitsubishi, SoftBank, Sony, et cetera, and they almost are the same weightings. So you're really getting sort of a similar product here. And again, if you're a client of J.P. Morgan and you were in EWJ and they were offering you something 30 basis points cheaper for the exact same exposure, you could see how that can work into the product's favor.
Drew, in a piece you wrote at ETF.com last week, you made the point that guess who the largest shareholder of EWJ is? It's J.P. Morgan. And you mentioned the flows out of EWJ. Obviously, we're talking about the flows into BBJP. Is it as simple as just putting two and two together? Is it just flows out of EWJ and J.P. Morgan putting those into BBJP?
Well, it's not scientific. Of course, with a mutual fund, there's a little bit more transparency of ownership because you're dealing with a mutual fund company, and when you redeem, you're dealing right with that company, so they know who their clients are. Being an exchange-traded fund, just like, you really don't know who owns Apple shares. You really don't know. But, I mean, it's not hard to figure out. EWJ's largest shareholder is J.P. Morgan, and we saw some symmetrical inflows and outflows. I think at the end of July, we had $1.5 billion go into the new Japan fund, as we saw $1.5 billion leave EWJ. And there's really no news narrative to cause that. And the other thing to point out that when we say that J.P. Morgan owns it, they own it for their clients, and they also own about nearly $80 billion worth of ETFs. As an ETF issuer, they currently have about $11 billion in their own products. So as they move along here, and we don't expect this to be a one-off, we already have another fund, a European fund, BBEU, which is the beta builder European fund from J.P. Morgan, also in the last 2 months has seen some $400 billion in assets. And we expect this to be a slow build-out. Again, Europe, Japan, those are pretty easy pockets of diversification for especially big clients.
You mentioned J.P.'s built-in client base and distribution, and I actually think this is the bigger part of the story. Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas calls this BYOA, right? Bring your own assets. Can you maybe explain what that strategy is in terms of building out an ETF business and why J.P. Morgan is in such a good spot here?
Sure. Well, there's 2,000 ETFs now. So the idea if you're going to build something and come, and people or investors will come, is a little bit far-fetched nowadays, especially when you're talking about plain vanilla funds, right? Here's a Japan fund. It's almost exactly similar to the EWJ, the iShares fund, but it's more expensive, EWJ. So you're offering something cheaper to your clients who are probably in this. Again, I want to make sure to be clear. This is conjecture, but I think it's pretty logical what we're seeing going on. And so the idea is that you bring a product to your clients before you actually put it on the market. And that helps in a lot of ways. One, tradability, spreads. A $2 million fund is going to trade a lot differently than a $2 billion fund, as you know, Nate. And so that immediately brings some liquidity there. And we've seen a lot of these one-offs where, in fact, Goldman Sachs launched an environmental, social, and government fund, ESG, ticker there, JUST, J JUST. Came out with $250 million right off the bat, but never gained anything more since then this year. But what we're seeing, which is a little different with BBJP, I think the headlines also start to beget assets, that people are starting to see, well, this is a fastest-growing fund, and they start reading it, seeing it's cheap. So I think, you know, there is a herd mentality that is always a behavioral finance issue. But at the same token, I think we're seeing a little bit of a snowball. Just on the other flip side of the coin, Nate, there is another beta builder that J.P. Morgan released at the same time. It's a REIT. It's the J.P. Morgan Beta Builders MSCI U.S. REIT ETF. It has $50 million in assets. And for a fund that's 2 months old, a lot of issuers would be really happy with that. And granted, it's not the big headline assets that we're seeing with BBJP. But still, again, if you combine these three new beta builder products, you're talking over $2 billion in assets in the last 2 months, which represents something more than 20% almost of J.P. Morgan's ETF assets under management. Pretty good summer.
How do you think someone like iShares is feeling about this? You mentioned earlier that J.P. has, $80 billion invested in ETFs overall, not just their ETFs, everyone's ETFs. So I think your point being that there's a big chunk of change that could come out of competing ETFs and into J.P. Morgan products. Do you think that's on iShares' radar?
Sure, but I think a lot of us would agree that we've been waiting for this. I mean, J.P. Morgan is no small player. And as I said in my blog, they get up very early in the morning to figure out how to get a piece of this $3.6 trillion pie. And now with, you know, over the last couple of years, we saw with the fiduciary rule and clients' best interest, the clients are really clamoring for cheap products that give them basic vanilla coverage. Tactical active management will always be there, but I think just the overall sense of investors now is, you know, Jack Bogle calls it, you know, you can control the cost. So people want cheap cost. And if you're a J.P. Morgan client and they're offering you a similar product, there might be some capital gains reasons not to. But on the same token, I think this is just the beginning of what we're going to see. The new issuers are not coming in hoping and throwing spaghetti on the wall that people will invest. They're basically moving clients into these funds. And if the rest of the public wants to jump on board, why not?
Well, on that note, what does JP's ETF lineup look like overall right now? And is there anything noteworthy in the hopper? I've actually said I think they should launch a full suite of low-cost ETFs, core ETFs, because of their distribution. Obviously, they can play that low-cost game. You mentioned the European ETF, the REIT ETF, but what does their overall lineup look like?
Well, that's a good point. However, on the contrary, we have a story up on ETF.com this morning on J.P. Morgan filing for an active core bond ETF. So now we're taking the other side of the coin where, again, there's a brand here. They call it the J.P. Morgan Core Plus Bond ETF, and it's going to invest in a range of corporate, government, and mortgage asset-backed debt. But it's going to be active. So they really have the palette of investment choices. You can get your plain vanilla beta builder. I expect them to probably have some kind of S&P, you know, plain domestic offering. But we're also seeing they're not going to be shying away from active either. So I think we're going to see a broad range. And again, the evolution of ETFs seems for some people that have been in the industry a while like it's rolling, but for others, I think we're just seeing the beginning of some different, at least industry-wise. And everything's good for the investors. These things are just getting cheaper and cheaper.
Well, and on that note, you know, we've sort of gotten into the weeds a little bit today, just looking at the back end of this. But what do you think the key takeaways are for investors in all of this?
Well, again, probably not for the retail investor. Does it matter? Are you in Japan? A lot of people really don't focus on an individual single country, even though there's a lot of money in that. A lot of that is institutional. A lot of that is diversification, so it's not a play per se. But on the other hand, I think this is all good for investors. Like I said, the expense ratios continue to go down, and here we have two products. One has 30 basis points difference per year. Doesn't seem like a lot, but over the years, hey man, you know, every percent counts.
We have about 2 minutes left, and I guess unrelated, but on this topic of expense ratios, before we let you go, I did want to ask you about the big news from Fidelity last week, right? They launched two self-index mutual funds that are free. They have a zero expense ratio. Any initial thoughts on that move?
Yeah, well, one, just to be clear, two things kind of, they don't bother me, but one, just keep in mind, this is not, you just don't get on the phone and get these. You have to be a client of Fidelity. And these are mutual funds, so they're not traded on an exchange. If they were traded on an exchange for free, I think that'd be a little different, because that means it's free to anybody. It doesn't matter where you're buying it at. So this is also sort of a proprietary product. Two, the other thing, too, all, you know, the headlines are, oh, a zero-fee index fund. Well, what's the whole point of the story that is being buried is, what is the index fund? What are we talking about here? Are we talking about equities? Are we talking about S&P 500? So I get a little concerned people get caught up on the freeness. And they don't understand what, I mean, okay, yeah, it's free, but you know, you can go buy a Charles Schwab equity fund for 3 basis points. That's basically free. You know what you're getting. You're getting the S&P 500. I still am not quite clear. I wish the headlines had a little bit more clarity, actually what those funds are, as opposed to just being free.
Well, Drew, as always, appreciate your time. Look forward to chatting again soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Nate. Always a pleasure.
That was Drew Voris, editor-in-chief of ETF.com. And I do want to mention that next month, we'll actually be joined by J.P. Morgan's Josh Rogers. We're going to talk much more about J.P.'s approach to ETFs and their overall strategy. So be sure to catch that. That'll be on September 18th. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Toby Lofton, managing principal at BP Capital Fund Advisors. We'll look at the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. We are now going to spotlight two very innovative and unique ETFs. The first one is the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF, ticker symbol BOON, B-O-O-N. And as you can gather by the name and in the ticker symbol, this is an ETF that billionaire T. Boone Pickens has lended his name to. This ETF just launched back in February, and I'm now very pleased to welcome to the program Toby Lofton, managing principal at BP Capital Fund Advisors and founder of Triline Index Solutions, which manages the index behind this ETF. Toby is joining us via phone from Dallas. Toby, a pleasure to have you on the program today.
Hey, good morning, Nate. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Toby, first, how is T. Boone Pickens involved with this ETF?
Well, Nate, if you remember back in July of 2008, Boone launched the Pickens plan, and it was meant to address the shortcomings of past administrations who had promised energy independence by policy. And so what we've done is we've taken the principles of the Pickens plan and used them as the foundation for the design of the index. And so Boone is supportive, to say the least, but he is he loves that we've taken his thought leadership and crafted it into something that is actually practical and relevant and timely.
All right, so let's talk more about the ETF. Again, the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF. Walk us through the methodology here.
Yeah, so I guess to start with, you know, we asked ourselves, look, there's a lot going on in the U.S. in terms of energy production and supply and how that's affecting the rest of the world. That's been going on really since 2005. But there was no real way to invest in it in a way that was balanced. So we said to ourselves, well, let's look at the whole equity market through the lens of energy. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, here in the U.S., if you have cheap natural gas, for example, there are a host of industries that are going to benefit from that decreased fuel expense or feedstock costs relative to other competitors around the globe. So we said, all right, let's look at the whole market and decide how energy intensive is each company. And what we mean by that is how much energy do they burn, and then translating that into dollars. So the number of BTUs they burn and translate that into dollars, and then compare that to their revenue. And while that's a helpful start, the alternative way of looking at it is from a top-down perspective. And instead of saying, hey, this is an energy company because it has assets that are part of the supply chain, let's look at it through the lens of how the equity price is related to oil prices. We chose Brent crude oil because we believe that it is the global benchmark for the price of a British thermal unit, because it's seaborne and it serves as a better tool, whereas West Texas Intermediate, for example, is landlocked here in the U.S. So once we established that, we said, all right, let's start with the NYSE 1000, and let's run a correlation analysis to all stocks in that group, and we'll take, as a first step, the top 40th percentile. By the way, the correlation was not done just on the first month of Brent. Instead, we did it over multiple periods. So 3 month, 6 month, 12 month, 3 year, and 5 year. That was meant to rid any type of noise in the front end, and also to avoid any type of spurious relationships. And so then once we take the top 40th percentile, we apply a qualitative screen. And that qualitative screen is meant to knock out certain industries that don't really have a true fundamental relationship with oil prices. For example, banks. Banks don't really burn hydrocarbons. There are some banks that lend to energy companies, but that's not what we're trying to capture here. So at the end of the day, what you arrive at is a group of companies that reflect not only a relationship to oil prices, but the information that's contained in oil prices that's related to economic activity globally. And so these are U.S.-based companies, minimum market cap of $2 billion, and a minimum average daily trading value of $10 million. The index was actually designed to be able to underpin a fixed indexed annuity product and could be as large as $5 billion. But we started with the ETF, BOON.
And how many holdings total?
Yeah, we currently have 81 for this year, but the index is reconstituted annually. And so if you look at the 20-year back test, what you'll find is a range of roughly 75 to 125 companies comprising the index annually.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned that to determine individual companies, you look for what's called energy intensity. Can you perhaps give us some more detail on exactly how you measure that?
Yeah, so the initial way we look at it is we say, what is the economic value added by the company? And we measure that by saying, all right, here's the energy consumed, and that's the numerator. So we figure out how many British thermal units did a company actually burn, gas, oil, NGLs. And then we divide that by the total revenue or economic value added over a period. So we get some relationship between how much energy did they burn, and then compare that to their total sales. But then we go a step further, and we have four categories of what we call end users of energy. And there's cost takers, there's cost pushers, there are those who have a relative cost advantage, and then there's finally revenue or margin enhancers. And so within those four categories, there are different companies that rest within each.
Well, I was going to ask you, how might you exclude somebody like airlines, where theoretically their demand is going to pick up as the economy is doing well, maybe have oil prices increasing, but at the same time, that's a very costly input for airlines. How is something like that screened out?
Yeah, so airlines are typically, they fall into the bucket of the cost taker, and we don't necessarily like that particular category because they don't have as much control over the cost inputs and what ultimately happens to their bottom line. And traditionally, airlines have had a less stable business model, and we don't want folks to view the end user bucket as a hedge, where when oil prices go up, the traditional energy does well and the other side does poorly. That's not how this is built. This is really what you need to think of is as the traditional energy group, meaning the E&P, exploration and production, and oilfield services, usually does well in a rising price environment. Well, so do industrials and materials, for example, as economic activity begins to ramp. And usually when oil prices are going up, that's an indication that demand is strong, and so economic activity is ramping up along with it. So that's really the design or the spirit behind it.
Our guest is Toby Lofton, Managing Principal at BP Capital Fund Advisors. We're spotlighting the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF. Toby, can you maybe do a little compare and contrast between Boone and some of the other prominent energy sector ETFs? Obviously, this is a popular space for investors. Give us a few of the main points of differentiation here.
Sure. Well, you know, if you look at the XLE, for example, it's one of the largest ETFs in the energy space, and it's based on the global industry classification system by the MSCI. And you look at the top three constituents, and it's ExxonMobil, Chevron, and Schlumberger. Well, that's 45% of that XLE, whereas in Boone we've got equal weight across the 81 constituents, for example. But more importantly, if you look at the components, we are balanced across the energy value chain, meaning we have upstream, downstream, and end users, whereas when you look at the XLE or XOP or the OIH, they're specifically honing in on one part of the value chain as opposed to having a more balanced set of exposure. And what our intent is to maintain the upside but reduce the downside. And over a 20-year back test, when you look at the Sharpe ratio, the Pickens Oil Response Index has a superior number associated with it. Now, we realize that's a back test, but that's the spirit of the design by which Boone is built.
So if I were to maybe restate that, some of the other energy sector ETFs you're saying are more upstream companies where you have oil and gas producers, oil field service companies, and so perhaps they're a lot more sensitive to commodity prices, which can obviously be boom or bust. Is that sort of a fair way to state that?
That's exactly right. And look, if Boone were on the show with us, he would say, fellas, it's really tough to pick the tops and the bottoms. So what we're trying to do is make energy investable. And that's why we're redefining it. We think that the old GIX way of looking at things, that lens is not a bad lens. It's just not necessarily the one that you should view today's market in. I mean, I'll cite as an example, you know, the GIX changed the telecommunications sector recently, and we viewed that as a rear view mirror type maneuver, whereas what we're trying to do is look at the market in relative terms as opposed to absolute terms, because we think that's a more contemporary method of going about it.
Toby, we have a few minutes left. Let's talk more about the overall investment case for energy. Why own something like Boone in a portfolio?
Well, look, when you zoom out and you say, okay, what's happened here in the U.S., from an energy perspective, let's turn to the supply side for a minute. So back in 2005, you had the Barnett Shale here in Dallas-Fort Worth kick off as really the first shale play to be developed in earnest. That was primarily natural gas, but we turned our attention to oil and liquids back in 2009, and the inflection from, say, 5 million barrels per day of oil production to today, we're north of 10 million barrels per day of production here in the U.S. That's led to the U.S. becoming a global exporter of crude oil. I mean, last month, we had 3 million barrels per day of crude oil exit the U.S. As late as December of 2015, we were exporting zero because there was an export ban. So there are huge movements that are unfolding on the supply side that's affecting the global energy markets. Now, I say all that, and then it naturally begs the question, well, which companies benefit? Well, there's companies in the Permian, for example, in West Texas, who represent that the total recoverable oil and the production is larger than the country of Iran. And so most people don't realize that the Permian is becoming almost its own state of oil production that affects the rest of the world. Tons of work that we do fundamentally to identify the companies that are benefiting there, but that the U.S. is going to continue to play an increasing role in oil supply.
Toby, you mentioned a movement. What about the movement towards clean energy, right? Solar, wind, water. There's obviously a lot of focus around climate change and the environment. Is that a potential longer-term risk at all in this particular sector?
Yeah, it certainly is. But you know, I would take you to the fact that one of the constituents in the oil index, oil response index, is First Solar. And the reason it's in there is that when you think about solar projects, it's connected to oil prices because all energy is connected to some extent. And we view First Solar almost like a series of call options on oil prices. And so we're cognizant of what's going on with respect to renewable energy. In fact, that was part of the Pickens plan. It was about anything American, whether it was wind, solar, nat gas, you name it. We wanted to be energy independent. So over time, I think the Pickens Oil Response Index will adapt according to the rules and the methodology that we've built, and it'll address the question that you're asking.
Well, Toby, great spotlight today. Really interesting approach to the energy space. Certainly wish you all the success. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Nate. I appreciate it.
That was Toby Lofton, Managing Principal at BP Capital Fund Advisors and founder of Triline Index Solutions. Again, the ETF is the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF. And you can learn more about this ETF by visiting tbooneetf.com. That's tbooneetf.com. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll spotlight another very innovative ETF, the Defiance Future Tech ETF. This focuses on augmented and virtual reality. We'll be joined by the CEO of Defiance ETFs, Matt Bielski. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. The next ETF we're going to spotlight today is one that just launched last week. It's called the Defiance Future Tech ETF, ticker symbol AUGR. This focuses on investment opportunities surrounding augmented and virtual reality technology. And joining us via phone from New York to discuss this ETF is Matt Bielski, CEO of Defiance ETFs. Matt, great to have you on the program today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Matt, before we get to the ETF, I thought it might be helpful to first have you provide some background on augmented and virtual reality for people who may be unfamiliar with this space. And I know there's a lot of cutting edge technology here, but just high level, what is this?
Yeah, sure. You know, so virtual reality is really meant to put the user in a simulated environment by really a computer generated type of experience. You're kind of entering this simulated world where augmented reality really enhances your actual world with a digital interactive experience in real time. So virtual reality, you're entering a simulated environment where augmented reality is really enhancing your current real environment in real time.
In terms of augmented reality, I feel like this really went mainstream with Pokemon, right? Do you think that's when augmented reality sort of flashed on everyone's radar?
I mean, actually, if you go back to 90s, I don't know if you watch NFL or Monday Night Football, but you know, back in, I think it was 1998, is when the NFL first implemented that first down yellow line. And that's really an example of augmented reality in sports for the first time. And since then, it's really, you know, evolved and proliferated from sports to gaming into real, you know, live type of, you know, sectors like medicine and healthcare.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned sports. Just last week, I read an article in the Kansas City Star here in town where they talked about how the Sprint Center, which is the arena here, they're actually going to test augmented reality for some college basketball games where fans can hold up their phones, face them to the court, and get immediate stats on players. They can track their movements. It really is amazing. It does seem like we're just scratching the surface with this technology. How has it evolved, I guess, in the sports arena from back in the 90s?
Yeah, I mean, if you watch the NBA finals, you saw, augmented reality, live in real time with, the announcers going onto the court and literally standing next to Steph Curry as he's, shooting a half-court shot. So you really experience for the first time really tangible in the NBA finals most recently. But I think more important than sports is really seeing how it evolved into the healthcare field. And, at Defiance, that's where we really believe it's going to, cause real disruption. And if you look at augmented reality and why it will cause disruption is, imagine, a surgeon doing a surgery. And before augmented reality, the surgeon actually had to cut open the individual to perform the surgery. With augmented reality, let's say you're doing a surgery on a tumor in your brain, now you can use augmented reality to see the actual tumor live in 360 degrees before going into the surgery. And that's why we think, augmented reality from both real-life surgeries and training is really going to kind of change, the healthcare type of sectors.
All right, so let's talk about the ETF, the Defiance Future Tech ETF. Again, ticker symbol AUGR. Explain for us what this ETF holds, how many holdings, how holdings are selected, anything else noteworthy.
Yeah, sure. So this ETF really covers three main sectors within augmented and virtual reality. The first is interfaces and displays. That's about 36%. The second is gaming, which is around 20%. And the third sector is AI and machine learning software, which is about 15%. So what we do is we benchmark to the Blue Star Augmented and Virtual Reality Index, which provides stocks to around 60 companies globally across all market caps. So you're going to get exposure to stocks in the U.S., France, Japan, and Korea. And what's really important to note is that the index methodology is equally weighted. So you'll get exposure to companies like, Facebook and Apple, but you also get companies to less known companies like Dassault, Systems, Faro Technologies, et cetera. So it's a great way to kind of get, precise exposure to companies developing and implementing the technology behind augmented and virtual reality.
In perusing the holdings of the ETF, you mentioned Facebook. They stuck out to me, Walt Disney. I know Facebook has some sort of a VR headset. Can you maybe tell us more about what both of those companies are doing around AR/VR?
Yeah, sure. So, Facebook, I think it was in 2014, they purchased Oculus VR for about $2.3 billion in cash and stock. And, they've been really pushing out that VR set. My wife bought me one. It's actually really, really cool. So they're definitely in the forefront of the actual VR headsets. And Disney is doing something really cool where they're launching a virtual reality vest. So imagine entering this simulated world, right? So visually you experience all these things, right? And then you have a vest where you can physically experience. So that's almost like mixed reality. An example would be putting on a virtual reality headset and a vest and playing a boxing video game. So imagine boxing and actually feeling the punches on your body. So think about how that would really shape training for sports. For example, and that's led by Walt Disney, the vest.
Matt, we've touched on sports. You mentioned a really interesting example with healthcare, obviously Facebook and what they're doing, Disney. I'm curious, are there some technologies that maybe the average investor wouldn't be aware of or hasn't heard about in this space, maybe something off the beaten path?
The actual exposure?
Yeah, just in terms of the underlying technology itself and what's occurring around AR/VR.
Yeah, I think another example, I served in the military, and I think, one thing we used was virtual reality headsets to actually experience, what it would be like to enter, a military, conflict zone. So you think about from a military standpoint, right? You look at the Marines or the Navy SEALs doing a mission, abroad. Think about actually they can experience what it's like to go into an unknown place to perform a mission. So we think from a military application as well, it's going to disrupt and really, help protect our troops abroad.
Our guest is Matt Bielski, CEO of Defiance ETFs. We're spotlighting the Defiance Future Tech ETF, ticker symbol AUGR. Matt, where did the idea for this ETF come from?
Well, actually, the funny part is my wife actually bought me one of those Oculus virtual reality headsets for Hanukkah, and then I launched my ETF company, and she was like, "You should launch an ETF for that." So then I kind of took a deeper dive, and I looked if there was actually a virtual and augmented reality ETF in the ETF space, and at that point there really wasn't. And I looked at what's kind of taking over the investment world and its disruptive technology. So we really saw a fit for this in an asset allocation portfolio, as a complement to broad-based, kind of cheap technology beta like QQQ. So really for a missing piece in a disruptive technology asset allocation model.
Well, on that note, any thoughts on thematic ETFs as a whole? I feel like sometimes they seem to take a lot of heat. People will say they're too niche, they're too gimmicky, too risky. You really hear it all. And maybe some of that is warranted in certain cases. But in your opinion, what makes for a good thematic ETF?
Yeah, I think really maintaining the integrity of the underlying theme you're trying to benchmark. I don't even like using the word thematic because I really think it perverts what we're trying to accomplish. So we're trying to give you, disruptive beta exposure. And by equally weighting an index, right, that's the first step in really constructing a good product because, FANGs in, everyone's portfolios. By having equal weight exposure, the smaller growth companies, in that index have the same exposure to a company like Facebook and Apple. But more importantly, you have to ask yourself this, where does it fit in a portfolio? So if you have a thematic ETF that's kind of, whether it's political driven or just trying to capture, the theme of the week, there really isn't room for that. For ETFs like augmented reality and ones that focus on specific technology themes like quantum computing, there is a place for that in the portfolio, and that's in the technology sleeve as an alpha generation.
Matt, overall, we've touched on a number of the different technologies in this space, but can you maybe just state the overall investment thesis here, the investment case? Why might investors want to look at this longer term?
Yeah, I mean, technology of our parents is not technology of today. If you look at what is real technology, it's the disruptive sectors, not only augmented and virtual reality. It's cybersecurity, it's robotics, it's AI, it's machine learning, it's quantum computing. And, we think that these companies and these subsectors are going to really change, all sectors across the board, and it's going to become more important to have exposure to these type of companies in a portfolio.
Matt, I'm just curious, what's your background? How did you end up starting a new ETF company? You mentioned the background on the ETF. What's your background?
Yeah, great question. My background, I'm an ETF guy. I've only worked in, ETF throughout my career. I worked at, ProShares and on the portfolio and trading side and helped structure some of the leverage products there. Got great experience in being on the, BlackRock iShares team and really, covering kind of top clients and understanding kind of the core of where ETFs fit in the portfolio. And then most recently, I was at Direction, a premier leverage and inverse ETF provider where I covered really, large institutional type of clients, which got me really, good experience. So I've been always in ETFs, but I've also personally invested in a lot of Israeli tech startup companies, which really kind of, sparked my interest in technology. And I looked at the competitive landscape, and I realized there was really a missing piece of a company that really focused purely on passive disruptive technology exposure. And that's what we're going to focus at here at Defiance.
Where did the name of the company come from?
That's even a better question. So the name, Defiance, it's actually a movie about my grandfather, Zeus Belsky. He staged the largest armed rescue of Jews by Jews in the Holocaust. So back in, I think it was 08, the film came out, and actually Lev Schreiber played my grandfather in the film, and Daniel Craig played his brother. So we named the company after that story, but more importantly, I think the name Defiance also fits into kind of the disruptive technology themes we're trying to really benchmark to as well.
All right, we have just a few minutes left here. I know you probably can't speak to specific details, but can you perhaps give us any sense as to what might be in store for Defiance ETFs moving forward?
Yeah, I can talk very, very broadly. we want to provide passive exposure for disruptive tech. So we're gonna you know, really focus on the themes that are kind of missing in clients' portfolios. So, you know, we can't talk about products that aren't filed for, but, you know, we just filed for a quantum computing ETF. That ticker's QTUM. And, you know, we're going to be launching a bunch of other, you know, products that are kind of in that space. We want to offer basically really a full model portfolio of carving all disruptive tech in a utopian world of portfolio.
And I have to ask you, you mentioned your background. You've been at ProShares, iShares, Direction. As you look forward just at the ETF industry as a whole, what do you think the future looks like? You know, there's certainly a laser-like focus on fees. We've seen the growth in areas like smart beta. There's a lot of buzz around ESG, but, you know, the assets haven't necessarily been there. What's your overall outlook on the ETF space?
Yeah, so at Defiance, we don't believe in smart beta. We think there's going to be continued fee compression by the big players, you know, iShares and Vanguard, and, you know, they're going to go after the fixed income space where we think there's a huge opportunity. You know, we think, you know, potentially $1 to $2 trillion, but that's not really the space that we're competing in. We think that there's going to be a lot of fee compression and a lot more competition coming into the market.
So what do you think just about the overall growth of the industry moving forward?
I mean, if you look at the numbers, I think it was BlackRock or Schwab who put in a report that's around, you know, $5 trillion in ETFs, and over the next 5 years can go anywhere from, you know, $10 to $20 trillion. So we think with the proliferation of fee-based business, advisor fee compression, natural adoption of ETFs from overly priced, you know, benchmark-hugging mutual funds, and we think that, you know, there's only going to be continued growth, and we think this is really... And I've been in ETF since 2008, and to see how they've grown and become so popular, you know, I still think we're at the beginning phases of, you know, ETFs.
Well, Matt, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Really appreciate you joining us on the program today. Congratulations on the launch, and best of luck to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
That was Matt Bielski, CEO of Defiance ETFs. Again, the ETF is the Defiance Future Tech ETF. And you can learn more about that ETF by visiting DefianceETFs.com. That's DefianceETFs.com. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, and also on iTunes. You can follow me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. We have a fantastic show for you next week. We'll first be joined by Jerry O'Reilly, Principal and Portfolio Manager at Vanguard. He's going to give us an inside look at managing index funds. So you think of index funds as just being on autopilot and there's really nothing to do. Couldn't be further from the case. So Jerry will take us behind the scenes. And then Todd Rosenbluth, Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA, will talk about Fidelity's recent announcement to offer free index funds. Should be a great show. Until then, have a great week, everyone.